From KU, we are news in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. On May 10th of 1994, the Archbishop Desmond Tutu stood on the town hall balcony in Cape Town, South Africa, to present to his people the first freely elected president of their country. As Nelson Mandela stood by, Tutu shouted to the crowd, "This is the day of liberation. We, of many cultures, languages, and races, are become one nation. We are the rainbow people of God." Today in the program, we have a conversation with Desmond Tutu. We'll talk about his role in helping his country heal from the brutality of apartheid. Tutu and others were faced with various paths to take. They chose forgiveness, something Tutu says is an essential element of African consciousness. But justice also had to be dealt with, how to forgive without forgetting. Desmond Tutu today, after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. One of the deepest expressions of faith, on May 10th of 1994, the day that Nelson Mandela was to be inaugurated as the country's first freely elected president, came from Mandela himself. Nelson Mandela, of course, had spent 27 years in jail, a prisoner of the apartheid regime. And on the day he was to be inaugurated, he invited his white jailer to attend the ceremony. It was a move the Archbishop Desmond Tutu would call a show of breathtaking magnanimity and a willingness to forgive. Today in the program, we're talking about forgiveness with Archbishop Tutu. Tutu, of course, helped orchestrate the effort to heal his country after apartheid. He received the Nobel Peace Prize in 1984 for his leadership during the struggle for freedom in his country. He's in Utah as part of the 2002 Olympics, of course, and as part of the Reebok Human Rights Awards. And we're honored to have him with us in studio this morning. And Archbishop Tutu, thank you and welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a beautiful, beautiful place.
Good. Well, and you have a great view.
Isn't it wonderful? Yes. I mean, I'm looking across at those snow-clad mountains, and it's unbelievable.
Yeah. You had hoped in 1996, when you were to retire as Archbishop, that you were going to have a true life as a retired man, a normal life. And I wonder if your life these days is at all normal, or what you thought it would be.
Yes, I suppose, I mean, normal is what you make it to be.
Yes.
It was, in fact, an incredible privilege, even if in many ways a painful privilege, to have been asked to help our country heal. And having been involved in the struggle against apartheid, it doesn't happen to too many people that you see the successful outcome of that struggle. And then to have the incredible privilege of introducing Nelson Mandela to the world, to South Africa, as the newly elected president. And I thought, oh, well, God, if I were to die now, I'd die happy. And then God said, well, we haven't finished with you, man. And then this incredible privilege of being asked to preside over the Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
I wonder, and forgive this maybe too thick a question this early, Father Tutu, but I wanted to get your perspective on God's will for mankind. Mm. In the awful days of apartheid, during the moments of darkness as you described them, you kept sounding this refrain, this is God's world and God is in charge.
Yeah.
Are you still devoted to that idea?
Oh, absolutely and utterly, yes. I often say to people in the dark days when sometimes you had to hold on to your faith by the skin of your teeth, you said you sometimes wished you could say to God, hey, why don't you make it slightly more obvious that you are in charge? And there must be moments such as your September the 11th, moments such as when you have the Holocaust, Rwanda, Afghanistan, the Middle East. And you say, for goodness sake, God, where are you? And the incredible thing is to have a God who extraordinarily is the omnipotent one, the all-powerful one, who is also the impotent one, the weak one. Because this God is a God who has an incredible reverence for our freedom as human beings, letting us make choices even when they are wrong choices and they are going to lead to the most awful mayhem. God doesn't usually intervene. But God is there as the God in the fiery furnace, you know, when the three servants were cast into the fiery furnace by the king. God didn't stop them being thrown into the fiery furnace, but God was there, Emmanuel. God is there with us in the pain and in the anguish, in the suffering.
I wonder if you have wondered about, in God's plan, why it seems suffering is so central.
Yeah. In one way, of course, you have to claim that we are dealing with a mystery and have to say that there is a proper agnosticism that we must acknowledge and not pretend that we are God, that there are things we wouldn't know. And yet, you know, I mean, when you come to think of it, in the structure of this universe, how do you get to be able to demonstrate courage unless it is that it is because you are going to take a risk, and the risk could lead, if you failed, to danger, to anguish, to pain, and maybe even to death. How do you demonstrate that? How do you demonstrate compassion and generosity? Just recently, I was with a couple who had just been told that the wife has inoperable cancer. And they said to me, you know, when we left the doctor, we went into our car and both of us started weeping like children. And then we went and bought, she says, my favorite bottle of champagne. Incredible. To celebrate and give thanks for all that had been, for all that God had given them. And the fact that they were given something that isn't usually the lot of many people. People die in accidents. She says, well, I have been given the opportunity of making my peace with people I have hurt and to prepare for death. Now that deep kind, how would we have that had it not been for the pain that you have?
Yeah. There was a moment I wanted to ask you about when you were a young boy. I've read about. You were 14 or 15 years old, and you had been struck by this brutal form of TB and almost died of it.
Yeah.
And you relate this experience where you had this kind of, I don't know, epiphany, this moment when you came to accept God's will. Would you talk about that?
In some ways you get a little scared about exposing that side of, I mean, you know, our Lord saying there are some things that you have to keep quiet about. But sure. I have spoken about it, and so it is in the public arena.
You don't have to ask.
No. I will. I mean, you are gentle and nice. They've not always been that way. I was in hospital and had seen other patients who were coughing up blood that almost always they ended up dying. And on this occasion, I was coughing up blood, and I went into the bathroom and started coughing, and then I had this hemorrhage. I don't know. I mean, I just said to God, look, if I'm going to die, it's okay. If I'm going to live, it's okay. I can't say that I was particularly religious, but I experienced an extraordinary kind of serenity, peace, on this particular occasion.
Do you figure that's how you'll be judged? Is by your capacity to accept God's will?
You know, God is on our side. You know, this is the incredible thing, and that God is on the side, especially of the weak. God is on the side even more extraordinarily. God has a soft spot for sinners. You know, I mean, we have our set of standards, you know, and we reckon that you must be rewarded for success, and we suffer from the success ethic. We want our children not just to do well, but I mean to wipe the floor with the opposition, as it were, at school, and we get to a point where stomach ulcers become a status symbol. And we reckon that is how God operates with us, that God loves us, God accepts us because we are good. And, hey, that is not the gospel. The gospel is God loves us, and everything else flows from that. And so God is not sitting and saying, now I've got you. And puts us through our paces. God is hoping that we will recognize that the most fundamental truth about us is you are loved, you are affirmed, you are accepted, and everything then is a consequence of this. You move out of that. You do good things not so that God should love you. You do good things almost as if to say to God, thank you. And so when we think of judging, God is judging in a way, confirming our own judgment on ourselves. Because we know when we have fallen short.
You said that God has the soft spot for sinners. I remember somewhere where you said that one of the people you wanted to first meet in heaven was Mary Magdalene, this flawed person. But what you described as a gorgeous creature in your mind.
I'm very fond of her. She's one of my patron saints because there's a wonderful book, Davidson's Story. And it's just playing on the fact that Jesus was the son of David, the Davidson story, and it's a TV spectacular.
Yeah.
And Mary Magdalene faces a very aggressive interviewer, and who's trying to make out that the relationship between her and Jesus is not quite kosher. And so he's making innuendos and things. And she bursts out laughing and says, do you mean I love him? Of course I love him. And sort of pulls the carpet from under this guy's feet. But she's tremendous because, you see, that's precisely who she is. Shown in the fact that she can be so extravagant. She uses almost all of her money to go and buy this expensive perfumed oil. And what does she come to do with it? it's to pour it over his head, and she makes a spectacle of herself. She weeps all over him, wipes his feet with her hair. I mean, she wasn't a decent girl in terms of the way people operate in the day, but she's accepted. She's accepted because she loves. And I am going to want to embrace her because she gives so much hope and makes us realize, hey, God is on our side. Stop fighting. I mean, God is on our side. Like, have you ever met a mother who pushing her pram with a baby and someone comes along and says, gee whiz, now that's an ugly baby. No mother, even if she were to have admitted deep down in her that he's not looking too nice, would ever admit that I have an ugly child. And when the child gets into trouble later on, the mother is not going to be saying he stole. When in our situation, they were used to say, she would say, they say he has stolen, you know, he is a thief, they say. But she wouldn't admit. And God is like that. God is, I mean, God thinks that we are the greatest thing God ever invented. You are the best thing that God ever created. I'm the best thing. I'm an original. You are an original, a glorious original. And God rubs God's hands in deep satisfaction. I mean, looking at you and saying, isn't he neat? You know.
Desmond Tutu, the name of his book is No Future Without Forgiveness. We're going to take a brief break right now. You're listening to Radio West on FM 90. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the Archbishop Emeritus of Cape Town, Father Desmond Tutu, is with us this morning. I wanted to ask you, Father, I wonder if you would be willing to take us back to April 27th of 1994. It was the first day that you and your people had been allowed to actually vote in a democratic election. You were 62. It was the first time you were able to vote. It's extraordinary for so many of us. You've said the air was electric. Talk about that day.
Well, when we went to bed on the 26th, you were so filled with apprehension and anxiety. Because, you see, up to a few days before, there had been bombs going off in Johannesburg at the airport, and we were scared that crazy lunatics were going to sabotage the election. We were all on tenterhooks that this thing might not come off.
Yeah.
And the day broke. In our part, I was in Cape Town at the time. It was a beautiful, beautiful day with hardly a cloud in the sky. I lived as Archbishop in the official residence of the Archbishop in a leafy, salubrious suburb of Cape Town called Bishop's Court. Wonderfully beautiful place. But I decided I was going to vote in a black township. And, you know, I mean, you had your heart in your mouth, as it were, as you went along, and you were wondering what you were going to hear, what you were going to see. And the long lines of people, it was unbelievable. The slow lines snaking their way to the voting booths. And I arrived, a great cheer went up, And how do you describe to someone falling in love? You know, the feelings that you have. I voted and slipped the ballot into the box and could only yell, "Yippee!" and did a little jig. And then I said I wanted to go and see what was happening in other places, because I was still very scared, as most of our people were scared. And I have to say, I was amazed, you know, and really on tenterhooks, because people could not have been more vulnerable. It would have taken just a few people with AK-47s to have thrown the most ghastly map. It didn't happen. There were all sorts of confusions that happened. Some places, ballot boxes had not arrived on time. Other places, no ink, not this. Everything that was conspiring really to undermine this. But we voted. And when I returned home, one of the men who were working on the property, a black guy, met me, and he was ecstatic. He said, "Father, I have voted. I have voted." And he was pumping the air with his fists. "I have voted." And I think it's perhaps people who have been unfree who really know what it means suddenly. I'm free. Hey, I'm free. I can walk tall. I can walk upright. I don't now have to apologize. I don't have to go around carrying a pass document to prove that I have the permission to be where I am. I'm free. And maybe white people too, after they voted for the first time in the genuinely free democratic elections, could say, "I'm free. The burden of guilt that I have been carrying as a white person, this has sloughed off me." And what would have been just a secular event in other parts of the world, for us became really a spiritual experience.
You've called it a trip to the mountaintop.
Yes, we were on cloud nine. You know, the euphoria was fantastic. Because one of the things that did happen, which was surprising, is that, you see, in these long lines, which ought to have spelled disaster, they turned out to be a good thing, especially when they were multiracial. Sure. Because whites, blacks, coloreds, Indians, suddenly it was as if the scales were falling off their eyes, and they looked and they didn't see a white person, but this is a fellow South African. Because they were exchanging newspapers, they were sharing sandwiches, and where maybe it was raining, they were sharing umbrellas. But they were also sharing the fact that, hey, we're actually human. These guys, these black guys, we've always been told were odd. I mean, they were talking about the things that they long for. They long for a decent home, a secure environment. They want good schools for their children. They want a good job. Well, I, white, seem to want the same things too. Mm. And it was an incredibly liberating, transfiguring experience.
You have said that one of the most important days in your life was the day that Nelson Mandela was finally released from prison after 27 years. And he came to spend the first night with you at Bishop's Court.
Mm-hmm.
What was that experience like, I wonder? And what did you come to learn from Nelson Mandela about the notion of forgiveness?
It was a remarkable day. I mean, it's a day when, as it were, the world and her husband were glued to television sets, and when he emerged with Winnie Mandela by his side, the world was united. Because, you see, the world had been part of our struggle for a very, very long time. And we are very, very fortunate. We know, I mean, that we wouldn't have made it without the incredible support that we did have from the international community. And one has to keep saying, thank you very much. We are free because you were there for us. We are democratic today because you were there for us. And so there was something that united the whole globe. It was a feeling that swept over the whole globe and said, it is true. Freedom can happen. When this man who was in jail for 27 years and somehow encapsulated all of us, when he walked free, we, all of us, somehow experienced a new freedom, an exhilaration. I had in fact been up in Johannesburg and had christened one of my grandchildren, and it was difficult to get a plane seat to go back to Cape Town, and we hitchhiked. We hitchhiked on a plane, and so managed to get back to Cape Town. But it was mayhem in many ways. You know, people waited for a very, very long time, and there was a time when some of his people had advised that he shouldn't go and appear at the city hall where all the people were waiting. And they told me, and I said, hey, do you want a riot? Because if he doesn't appear, many people are going to say they have been cheated. It's not true. He's not released. And so he appeared. And then he came to Bishop's Court. We had hardly a moment. The telephone was ringing. This is the White House. This is State House over there. This is, you know, and everybody, as they still do even now, wanted a piece of this man. And he was remarkable because he had, as he still seems to have, a kind of inner serenity, a genuine goodness about him. I didn't spend a lot of time because many of his ANC colleagues, some of them were meeting with him for the first time after several years. And so they used Bishop's Court living room for their meetings. But we started off, we said, we've got to have a prayer meeting. And we sang in Xhosa. There's a hymn that's almost like a national anthem, "Let Your Will Be Fulfilled." And we belted it out and then prayed. And then I disappeared until sort of the following morning when he had his first press conference.
And I wonder what you learned from him about the idea of forgiveness. And do you think, Father, that God requires it? And why?
We hardly ever discussed that. And the credit for the TRC, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, mustn't be given to me. Because, in fact, I wasn't involved in all of the preliminary discussions that led up to the appointment of the commission. It was many in the civil society who were talking about transitional justice, and members of the ANC who had already been saying, how are we going to handle transition from repression to democracy? And obviously looked at various options, Nuremberg, general amnesty, and they were honing and really working hard. People looked at examples in other countries and to see whether there was anything that we could learn. But I can say about him that he is extraordinarily magnanimous. He really is. I think, I mean, he can't help himself. And does God require it? We are made in the image of God, which means that apart from anything else, we're supposed to be, as it were, replicas. Frequently, the scriptures say, do such and such because God is your Father. I mean, our Lord would say, forgive. I mean, and we pray in the Lord's Prayer, forgive us as we forgive. And you say, what is the nature of God in many ways that we are supposed to represent? And a lot of it is the generosity of giving the other yet another chance. Because forgiveness is really saying to the other, I'm not going to box you up and say what you did defines who you are. I am giving you another chance. It is that when I have sinned, when I have hurt, say, my wife, and I say those words which are the most difficult in every language of the world, I am sorry, forgive me. And she says, yeah. It doesn't mean she has forgotten. It doesn't mean she condones. But it means she is saying, here is another opportunity. Make a new beginning. Because the Christian faith actually is a faith of ever new beginnings. There's a lovely story told, a Jewish story. This Jew goes up to God and says, God, I'm sorry. Please forgive me. I did this and this and this. And God says, yes, I've forgiven you. And he comes along again a few days later. And he says, God, I've done it again. And God says, what have you done again? That extraordinarily, God suffers from amnesia. God suffers from amnesia. God doesn't hold against us what we have done. God says, you have fallen. Okay. Stand up. Dust you off. Says, try again. And we fall. And God doesn't say, good riddance to bad rubbish. God says, get up. Dust you off. Try again. Because, as they sometimes say, God doesn't create duds. God creates masterpieces. And God hasn't finished on you or on me. God is still working on me. And God says, for goodness sake, be patient with yourself. I am.
The Archbishop Desmond Tutu is with us this morning. His book is called No Future Without Forgiveness. We're going to take a brief break right now. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Radio West on FM 90. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program with us is the Archbishop Desmond Tutu. He is, among other things, the author of the book No Future Without Forgiveness. Father Tutu, you, your people chose in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, you chose, as you mentioned, there was this standard of Nuremberg. The Nuremberg trial was one option. The other option was this notion of general amnesty, just sort of letting go in that sort of very general way. And you chose a third way. And you point out that this idea of I guess, forgiveness is the central feature of African consciousness. It's Ubuntu. Tell us what that is. Explain that.
Well, you've done it very well. Ubuntu comes... A person is called Umuntu. Ubuntu is the essence of being human, of being a person. And in our understanding, you can't have a solitary human being. And so we have a saying, a person is a person through other persons. Umuntu ngumuntu ngabantu. I need you in order for me to be me. And it seems so obvious. I mean, I wouldn't know how to walk except through learning it from other human beings. I couldn't think as a human being. I couldn't speak as a human being. I couldn't think. I couldn't, hardly anything I could do which I haven't learned from others. And that, therefore, we are part of what the Bible calls the bundle of life. And it's a very biblical notion, actually, that you wither if you are detached from your community. And because community is so important, the central thing then is harmony. Harmony. We've got to be able to live in peace. Anger, resentment, revenge, hatred are corrosive of this great good, this summum bonum. And therefore, to forgive is actually not doing a favor to the other person. It's the best form of self-interest. If I don't forgive, then the anger sits here in the tum-tum and is corrosive of your very essence. If I dehumanize you, whether I like it or not, in the process I am dehumanized. If you are diminished as a person, I am diminished inexorably. If you are enhanced, if your personhood is enhanced, I benefit as well. And so forgiveness, reconciliation are crucial. When an offense has happened in our community, you look not so much to punishment. The way you handle it is not to look for the punitive, but for the restorative. And so our justice is restorative justice and not retributive punitive justice. And so the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was, in a sense, also part of this. Of course, it was forced on us in many ways. We couldn't have gone the Nuremberg way because in Nuremberg there was a clear victor. In our situation, we had a deadlock. neither side had defeated the other. And it is quite clear now from the evidence that we came to get that our country would, in fact, have gone up in flames. There were arms caches all over the place. And if the security forces had known that we are going to have a transition, and then at the end of the transition, they are going to be arraigned, they would not, I mean, they were carrying the guns, and they wouldn't have agreed to that. We rejected the general amnesty, the saying, let bygones be bygones, right, because they aren't. They no. never become bygones.
Well, and accountability was
absolutely
important.
Yeah, I mean, we said, look, what you are not going to be punished, but you've got to acknowledge that you did something wrong. And it was also crucial for the victim. Because, you see, when you deny that something has happened to a person and they claim that it has happened, you are calling in question their integrity, but we are calling in question even more seriously their identity. Because, you see, I am what I remember. I am my memory. Without my memory, how would I know that I am me? And that is why Alzheimer's can be so devastating, because you see a person disintegrating before your very eyes, when the person no longer knows members of their family. It can be very, very distressing. And so we, when people were saying, but I mean, you are letting the perpetrators go free, we said, no, it isn't in fact the case. These people have to admit in public that they have done some of the most horrendous things. And that public, as it were, almost humiliation is a very, very heavy punishment. But remember, too, that our aim is not to punish. Our aim is the healing, not just of the victim. Interestingly, it is also for the healing of the perpetrator. We are hoping that the perpetrator can be reintegrated into society and become a more worthy, a more creative member of society.
So how do you look at the idea of justice then, in the sense that they had to, the perpetrators, let's say, had to acknowledge that they had done this horrid, horrific crime, then they would be granted this amnesty. Not general amnesty, but certainly conditioned upon that admission. But what about the notion of justice? Justice is not practical, certainly wasn't practical in the sense of South Africa.
No, but you see, that is precisely what I'm saying, that most people tend to think of justice as only one kind of justice, retributive justice, yeah. Justice where the perpetrator has to be punished for the offense. Now, we are saying, yes, there was actually a form of punishment in the exposure, but retributive justice is not the only kind of justice. There is restorative justice. Yeah. And also, of course, you've got to remember that we were saying that this is not how we are going to be operating all of the time. It is ad hoc. It is for the special purpose that we are making this transition. And we want the transition to succeed. Otherwise, if you keep on raking up the past in a way, it's like keeping scratching at a wound and leaving it open. We were saying, yeah, well, when you open the wounds, which were festering, cleanse them and then pour a balm. We were saying, we're going to do this as quickly as possible. And from then on, for goodness sake, let's stop harking back to the past and say, yeah, we have acknowledged that past. We have looked the beast in the eye. Mm. And now, together, we want to move into this glorious future that God has set out for us.
I wanted to ask you about You referred to the people who worked on the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. They've been referred to as wounded healers.
Yeah.
Was that an experience that there is also a wonderful reference in your book where you talk about how we are not dishwashers as much as vacuum cleaners. That is, we sort of suck up these things that are around us, and they have real effects on us.
Well, we were warned, don't become like vacuum cleaners. Don't take up this all of what you hear. Very traumatizing. And retain it within yourself. And that's why we were told it was important that you have a disciplined life, you have time for recreation, and have someone, a soulmate, with whom you can share some of your anguish so that you don't hold it in. Be like a washing machine, which takes out the dirt from the clothes and then spews it forth into the gutter. But what one was saying as well is that all of us have been wounded in different kinds of ways by apartheid. Mm. And also that none of us could gloat. None of us could feel superior and say, look at that perpetrator. We had to say, there but for the grace of God go I. Because those people were, to all intents and purposes, normal. They didn't have horns and tails. Mm-hmm. They went to church. They had children. They had birthday parties for their children. They got up in the morning and went to work, and they looked normal, but of course some of their work was carrying out torture. That none of us could say had the same conditions that applied to this man applied to me. I can't say I would not have turned out to be the same. And also, it was saying, no matter how ghastly the perpetrator might be, no matter how monstrous, how diabolical the acts that he committed, he, she still remains a child of God with the possibility of becoming a better person. That all of us are saints in the making.
You talk about forgiveness not being just sentimental or this abstract principle. And you talk about how the study of forgiveness has become something of a growth industry and an academic discipline and something that has a real effect on your life, that it's good for your health, you say, is also.
Yeah, well, I mean, they say at the very least, if you were nursing grudges and you discover, I mean, you'll see it in your blood pressure.
Right.
but in fact, it turns out that, you know, forgiveness is not something sort of nebulous. You see what not forgiving is doing to the Middle East, to Northern Ireland, to Sri Lanka, that where they are saying, because of this attack, we are going to have this reprisal. You have a suicide bomber, and you predict that the Israelis are going to do something to hit back. But it's a spiral. As sure as anything, after the Israeli reprisal, retaliation, you are sure as anything that there's going to be another suicide bomber. And now they have even women becoming suicide bombers. And you say, it really is real politik. Without forgiveness, there is not there's going to be no future. You can predict. I went to Rwanda after the genocide, and I said, your history is top dog and underdog. Top dog ill-treats underdog, and underdog wants to become top dog. And when underdog becomes top dog, they repeat, I mean, pay back to the former top dog. And it just goes on and on. And I said to them, you are not going to have a future until someone says, we're going to break this spiral by, yes, forgiveness. Talking about forgiveness. And I was in Tel Aviv and I said to them, we learned in South Africa, you will never get real security from the barrel of a gun.
I read somewhere, Father, where you wondered if they will have rum and coke in heaven.
Yeah, I think I'm in heaven is going to be great because one is going to be, you keep being surprised at the things that you discover. You know, someone said heaven is going to be like this. You see, because God is infinite, we are finite. Even when we are in heaven, we'll still be finite. Mm. And you will say, hey, have you seen this aspect of the beauty of God? And I say, no, I haven't. He said, come on. And we share that. And I will say, do you know that God is like this? You know, and it'll be that all of the time, and there won't be time, of course, but I mean, speaking as who we are, all of the time we will keep being surprised at the beauty of God.
Archbishop Desmond Tutu, he is the author of No Future Without Forgiveness. And Father, thank you very much for joining us.
God bless you.
Radio West is directed by Mike Anderson, produced by Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.